Hey, everybody. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host of V Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. And I'm also the founder and editor-in-chief of V Magazine, now in its 17th year, growing and growing digitally and in the print format that they said was going to be dead many years ago when I started. And it's not. It's probably coming back with a revival. I'm sitting here at the second day of the second annual Redfish Film Festival. And I just saw a film by Carrie Lederer, who you're going to meet in a minute, who's the documentarian and the filmmaker of Wild Horses, that I'm still trying to comprehend all that I saw and all that I felt. And it might take a couple of days, but when we get into this interview with Carrie, she will probably shed some light on some of the feelings that I had that were just tremendous. So, Carrie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, when did you know that you wanted to pick up a camera and become either a filmmaker and or a documentarian?
Yeah, good question. In college, I've always been a nature lover. And in college, when I started to learn about some of the environmental issues happening, ozone depletion, PCBs, global deforestation, I picked up a camera in college because I realized the power of the media. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make people aware of the issues. And so that's, I'd say, when I got into broadcast journalism. When I graduated from college, I worked for a nonprofit called Earth Network, again, focused on environmental issues, but social political issues, mm-hmm. spiritual issues, and we were able to put some of the films that we made on public access. Mm. Shout out to public access. It's very
yes,
important.
Very important.
And then it's kind of a long story, but I got my first sort of full-time job at CNN in their heyday.
In Atlanta?
During the first Gulf War, 1991, mm. yep, Atlanta. And this was before internet, and yet you could
right.
sit down at CNN and, yes. you know, what's happening in the world. So it was quite an amazing opportunity. I got pigeonholed into an editing position there. Mm. And, you know, we'd get a lot of international fees. I was there for about three and a half years, cutting the guts and the gore mm. out of the wars.
It was tough. Must have been.
And so I decided that maybe this wasn't where I wanted to be. There were other stories in the world that I felt were worthy of being told. Mm. And, you know, news, if it bleeds, it leads.
Mm.
And so I quit CNN and I joined the Peace Corps
mm-hmm.
As an environmental educator and media specialist. And I served in two countries, the Comoros Islands and Senegal, as an environmental educator and media specialist. Mm. And when I got out of the Peace Corps, I thought I would be a conservation biologist, but I got pulled back into media, mm. Worked for a lot of nonprofits around the world, did work for Smithsonian, UN, mm. And a lot of independent docs because mm. the digital revolution hit.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, you know, we could afford to have a camera. Final Cut Pro came out.
Right.
I could be an editor. And so I've always been a one-woman band. I've traveled the world with my camera on assignment. Reality trend hit, and finally we can make a paycheck. So, mm. You know, have worked for most of the major networks. Had a show on the Travel Channel in 2006 called Not Your Average Travel Guide, where not only did I produce, shoot, and edit, but I had to host the shows as well. Of course, right. nowadays with social media, everyone and their brother's a, you know, a right. travel host, but at right. the time, you know,
yes.
it was kind of a,
yes.
a pat on the back. So I've always stayed in nonfiction, mm-hmm. You know, nonprofit, mm. documentary, docu-reality series. And so fast wow. forward to today, and I really wanted to get back to my roots mm. As a documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And this story about John Wayne Smith was came to me through a Facebook post.
Mm-hmm.
So
he reached out to you?
No, actually. Okay. So John Wayne Smith has a Facebook page mm-hmm. with about 5,000 mm-hmm. followers, and he blogs about his life on a mesa in southern Colorado, okay. And the wild horses that he lives with, and their personalities, and what happens. And someone said, John, you should really have your story told. Mm-hmm. And a friend put my name in the comments, mm-hmm. Carrie, check out the story. Mm-hmm. Well, what is the story? And so I reached out to John, and John gave me a lot of his background, that he had lived unhoused for 8 years and struggled with alcoholism. But that he changed his life around now that he's living with these horses that provide him healing. And thus Wild Horses came to be. Wild Horses at the door, because they literally come to his mm-hmm. door.
Where was he living when he was homeless?
Yeah. So John is a fifth generation Coloradoan. Okay. He was living around the Vail area. Mm-hmm. So he'd lived in different ski towns, okay. which yeah. if you know ski towns, the real estate tends to be very yes. expensive. And was working, he'd been around horses. He'd worked on yes. a ranch out there. And the woman who owned the ranch passed, and it devastated him. And he struggled with alcoholism, mm-hmm. but he was starting to drink more mm-hmm. heavily mm-hmm. And ended up on the streets, but living in a bus that he owned.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. So in Minturn, Minturn is just outside of Vail, Colorado.
All right. So I shared with you right before we went on camera that because I just watched your film an hour ago, mm-hmm. maybe an hour and a half ago, and it was in the boxing club, which I think is a really cool place to show yeah. your film. I just thought it was amazing, like all the optics.
The fighting spirit.
Yeah, it was all there.
Of our subjects.
Everybody in the audience was asking questions after, so they were very moved by it. They were very interested. Mm-hmm. They were like really digging your film, as was I, but I was very quiet. And I was quiet because I was contemplative and doing a lot of thinking. One of the things that I'm still trying to articulate is, you know, when you see a lot of documentaries, you know someone's filming it. Mm-hmm. You can either like almost feel that there's a camera there or a person is there or maybe even hear it sometimes. And maybe not audibly, but it might be just in my mind's eye. As I was midway through watching your film, I was like, it doesn't seem like anyone's filming this. Like, how is someone doing this? Because you're getting so close to the faces of the horses. And it was so emotive and it was so lonely because there was a lot of loneliness in there, but then redemption at the same time, which is also confliction and like really kind of crazy to mix them all together. So I've come to the conclusion in the last hour and a half that it was genius that you were able to pull that off. How do you understand what I'm feeling?
Yeah,
okay,
I do. Is it? Well, I think something that I'm really attracted to in documentary filmmaking is creating an immersive experience so that I'm really bringing my audience into the experience of my subject. And a lot of us as documentarians say, oh, I'm a fly on the wall. But something that a device that a lot of film documentaries have are what's called the talking head, where you cut to an interview mm-hmm. and the person's there, and then there's maybe some verite scenes. In other words, you know, the reality of this character's story. And I made a decision when I was shooting it that, of course, I did shoot the interview. The talking head interview, but I didn't necessarily want to include the talking head interview mm-hmm. in the film. I wanted it all to be mostly kind of like a cinematic journey.
Yes, yes.
And sometimes that works well. I was concerned that if I didn't use the talking head, would the audience still feel the emotion? Because sometimes when you have that talking head and the mm-hmm. subject's looking mm-hmm. into the lens, and they get emotional, the audience really feels that emotion. Mm-hmm. But there was so much emotion happening for John. He's got two sides of him. He's got, you know, this very high when he's around the horses. Mm-hmm. But when they're not around and he goes into his head mm-hmm. and that monkey chatter happens. Mm-hmm.
He withdraws. Yeah,
he withdraws and gets very emotional, and so that was, you know, very natural. So I think as a one woman band too, I was the only crew out there, and so I think the subject starts to forget about the camera being mm-hmm. around, and mm-hmm. and you know, I just
you were literally immersed, not just figuratively.
Yeah,
you were
yeah.
literally there,
correct,
and had to spend time there
yeah.
and sleep in
sleeping off grid, yeah,
or, you know, and just and that would make, when the cameras are not rolling, there's an intimacy there mm-hmm. too, mm-hmm. which is rare,
yeah.
you know, because it's not like a lot of crew and you're right. like segregated, you
right.
know, you're just definitely together. So that had to be sad maybe when you left, because now the only, there was no human left except John.
Yeah.
And then his horses. And if it was in the winter, you know, they weren't going to be there. But the horses were magnificent yeah. and beautiful, and capturing like you did the horses lying down with him and sleeping mm-hmm. in the field, and just the length of time you decided to put on that, it was really, really intensely mm-hmm. beautiful.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Your Peace Corps experience, I think you had answered one of the questions yeah. where people are like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
And, you know, you were saying, well, like, I can do hard things. My words, not
right.
yours. But that, you know, you were able to go through some grit to basically get that. How pleased are you with the final outcome? And, like, what does this mean for you to be here? And where do you want this to go?
Okay. Should I delve into a little bit?
What,
I mean, as far as immersing myself, I mean, oftentimes when you're shooting a film, you know, you have a wrap time and you go back to your hotel mm-hmm. or you go back to your home and you step away from the subject. But, you know, in this case, it's this off the grid, Mesa in Colorado. And, I'm a camper, you know, I can rough it.
Mm-hmm.
And that also allowed for, as you said, a more intimate relationship. John and I got very close.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that lends itself, to him also getting more comfortable, you know, with the cameras, and the horses getting more comfortable with me
right.
around there
right.
as well.
Did you fall in love with the horses?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a horse person too.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That also what attracted me to,
right.
to the story is I do believe in the healing power of horses.
I do too.
I believe in nature therapy.
Yes.
I feel that nature cures all.
I do.
And so John, yeah, it was tough. It's hard for him. I mean, mm-hmm. John is extremely charismatic
yeah.
And you know, he still attends AA meetings,
yeah. mm-hmm.
But moving out to the Mesa, mm-hmm. there, you know, weren't a lot of meetings for him to go to.
Right.
He does talk to his sister every
uh-huh.
day, which is
yeah,
in the film. And so me coming out to the Mesa and living with him and sharing meals and having conversation and living mm-hmm. his life, it was deeply moving for him. So when I did leave, mm-hmm. there were times where we really did have abandonment issues. But we continued to speak daily and text daily.
Right.
I almost became like another sister to
right.
him.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. yeah. And we both were really excited about the film. I showed him the film finally
mm-hmm.
in January after I completed it. I drove back down to the Mesa because I wanted to sit there
yeah.
with him
mm-hmm.
as he watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Nervous,
what did
you
he
know.
Think?
Well, he loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for John wanted it to be all about the horses. You know, this isn't about me. This
mm-hmm.
is about,
mm-hmm.
you know, protecting and saving the horses. I said, yes, but you're the vessel through which we're, you know, coming to
mm-hmm.
understand the plight of the horses
mm-hmm.
and the plight of the homeless. And that's really powerful. And you're, you know, such a poetic voice for all these issues, such as homelessness, such as addiction, such as PTSD. And you know, the salvation of these horses.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, you know, it was a lot better than he thought it was going to
oh,
be.
Good.
Quite, yeah.
He's getting an agent tomorrow.
Yeah,
right?
Well, he would love that. I mean, I could see him in movies,
yeah.
you know, especially
uh-huh.
with the name John Wayne Smith.
Exactly.
Which in a way for him has been, you know, a blessing and a burden.
Right. Right.
Because as, you know, for those of you who are familiar with John Wayne, you know, the
mm-hmm.
rugged individualist, this John Wayne Smith, you know, having living that life realizes that it's not all it's cracked up to be. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. isolation does take its toll on you. I would just love this film to be seen by as many people as possible. I think when I set out to make it, it was more about I just want to complete a film. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the festivals were, oh, well, this is a great way to raise awareness about it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a little more profile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ultimately, my hope is that it has an impact, that people, you know, learn more about the homeless, learn more about horses, because a lot of people don't know about wild horses on our public lands.
Right, and then please. Could you tell our listeners and viewers exactly what is going on with the roundup of horses,
sure.
like you did in the the Q&A after the film?
Sure. So there's about 80,000 wild horses and burros, or mules, as maybe some people mm-hmm. know them as, mm-hmm. That roam in many states. I mean, everywhere from Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, California, mm-hmm. the Outer Banks in North Carolina, Virginia even, mm-hmm. probably Arizona. And in 1971, they passed the Wild Horse and Burro Act to protect these beautiful animals and give them the freedom to roam and to appreciate the American West. On Bureau of Land Management land, where they roam, they've started to overpopulate, as you know, which is a wonderful thing. It means they're thriving. Mm-hmm. But there's outside pressures. There's a lot of cattlemen and ranchers who also graze on the property. There's other species, some endangered, that are on some of these environments in these ecosystems. And so the Bureau of Land Management does what are called roundups, where they fly helicopters over and they literally corral horses and they sell them off at auctions. And their belief is, well, we'd rather they didn't starve. And they're going to be better off cared for, domesticated. Mm-hmm. The money that they make through these roundups helps to care for the horses, and it mm-hmm. also pays for those who may adopt a horse who don't have a lot of experience with it. It gives them a little bit of money. It's like adopting a dog mm-hmm. or a cat, but mm-hmm. horses are, you know, yes. a very different right. beast. And there's a lot of controversy around the roundups, as we see in the film. John is very much against the mm-hmm. roundups because horses form what are called bands. Mm-hmm. You have a lead stallion and mares that hang out, and you know he defends his band. Mm-hmm. And in these roundups, they split up the families. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine, you know, animals that are you know, taken away from their mother or what have you is cruel. Mm-hmm. So on the land that John lives, it's private property. Mm-hmm. And so most people who live out there intentionally to be around the wild horses. Mm-hmm. But it's a rough life. Again, mm-hmm. it's all off grid. But they love having the horses around. But John fears that perhaps there will be an intervention. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Yes. He disapproves.
Well, it's going to be very exciting to see where all of this goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a very storied past that I find very mm-hmm. interesting, the Peace Corps being one of them. Mm-hmm. Tell me what the 2-year stint in the Peace Corps did for you, and bring this to present day right mm-hmm. now, where so much has changed in the world mm-hmm. in a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. Are people still going into the Peace Corps?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, thankfully, you know, right. Peace Corps is still around. Right. My parents thought about doing the Peace Corps. Mm-hmm. Mom got pregnant, life yeah. went on. Right. So I'm not sure how I found through osmosis, how right. I learned about it. I you know, when I go right. back in my mind, I'm like, how did I even know that it existed? Mm-hmm. I wanted to take a more proactive role in my life. Mm-hmm. And felt that a lot of stories from a lot of developing countries tended to focus on war, famine, poverty. And I thought, God, there's so many other positive stories coming from these countries. And, you know, it's a process to be accepted into the Peace Corps. You have to have a college degree. I was years out. I was 27. A lot of people do it right when they're out of college. But then there's people up, you know, in their 70s who think, gosh, I want a new lease on life. I want to give back. I want to be in service. For me, Peace Corps was the most profound experience of my life. So like I said, I started in the Comoros Islands, which are a group of islands near Madagascar. A lot of people have heard of the Comoros Islands near Réunion and the Seychelles. And they were colonized by France, so French is spoken, but of course they have their tribal languages. And when you go into the Peace Corps, you start out with about 3 months of training. So you learn, you know, the local language. You're often do, you know, live with the family. You get some training in whatever area, whatever project area you're going to be working on. And then after 3 months, if you get through that, you know, with all the, you know, adjusting to the water and the food and just life, then you swear in and you commit to 2 years. And so I was dropped off in a village in the mountains on an island called Anjouan, where, you know, a white person hadn't necessarily stopped, let alone come to live. So it was very much the honored guest. but it was incredible. I was just me and ended up starting environmental action groups on every village in the island, and felt like I was preaching the obvious. I mean, what do I have to teach, you know, these people? They have a lot more to, you know, to teach me, the Comorians. And but yet what I discovered is that, you know, it was a caring capacity issue that maybe they hadn't connected all the dots. If you know, deforest the high mountains, there's erosion. They were extracting sand from the beaches, so there was no natural barrier between when it rained and erosion and the coral reefs. So the coral reefs were suffering, and so on and so forth. And so even though I might have been preaching some of what they knew, they started to realize, oh, okay. And we would discuss, well, what are some of the solutions, and then do that with the village, you know, engage in projects with the village. And after a year of creating groups in every single village, we secured money through actually USAID, God bless its soul, to have an island-wide conference. But then a military coup happened, and we were evacuated and had the option to either transfer to another country or return home without penalty. Because when you do 2 years in the Peace Corps, you know, you get a stipend to readjust back in the States, or college deferment, or maybe working on a master. So there's a lot of perks after the Peace Corps. Maybe you go into foreign relations. I decided to transfer, and because I was loving the experience. I'm a people person, you know, and loved learning this new language, you know, Mungunamunasuruni, you know, so how you greet the women, and Jeje, Habari Zaho. It's a Bantu-based language. Spoken in, it was like Swahili, but each island had their own dialect. Anyway, I transferred to Senegal. I had 10 days of now local language training in another country. Senegal's in West Africa. And after 10 days, dropped off in a hut between, you know, two villages. And, but for some reason, I think after a year, I kind of learned
quickly,
really quickly. you know, was embraced by the local people there. In fact, I heard Senegal has amazing music and beautiful dancing, and they're very expressive. And I heard music coming from the village. There was a baby shower, and all the women were decked out in their colorful boubous and dancing what's called sabar. And I went over and could, you know, greet them, and gosh, I would love to learn this dance. And they said, go ahead. And I'll sat down. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. And one woman got up and took my hand and started showing me the moves. And She became my soul sister in my dynamic duo. So yeah. I ended up staying for 2 years in Senegal. And
so you were there for 3 years?
Yeah, 3.5 years in total.
Well, yeah, that probably gave you such a base for the rest of your life,
right?
With everything that
exactly,
you're going to do.
Exactly, exactly.
It'd be hard to go from that to CNN.
Exactly, in reverse.
Yeah, yeah.
But what it does help, you know, again, it's immersion, you know. So even through all the productions I've done through docu-reality, mm-hmm. what I love is that I'm dropped into subcultures of America or wherever mm-hmm. I go, mm-hmm. and I have to assimilate really quickly and, you know, and gain the trust of subjects, mm-hmm. Although I'd like to call them participants,
yes.
and draw out their stories. Yeah. So, you know, that's 25 years of experience plus, you know, that I've had. So
amazing.
There you have now, yeah. you know, how I might have worked my way into John
yes,
Wayne's heart.
It's all becoming very clear to me. You, your whole life has prepared you for everything that you continue to do,
yeah.
you know, which
yeah.
is really awesome. Well, I hope the world sees this documentary.
Thank you.
I think it is incredibly well done on all fronts, and we're going to promote the heck out of it.
Thank you so much.
You know,
that means so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Especially for documentaries. I mean,
yes.
documentaries are, there's not a lot of outlets
yeah.
for, you know, or streaming. I mean, there are some docs,
yeah.
but they're not money makers. You know, they're labors of love and they're about the impact, about
right.
the message that audiences
yes.
take away from.
Yes. Well, I think it's going to resonate and I'm rooting
thanks.
For you and
thank
we'll
you
do
so
everything
much,
that we can.
Thank you. Lovey,
right.
lovey.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much
okay.
for having me.
Thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed this. I did. She's fascinating. Carrie's amazing. And we will put up on the screen QR code so that you can see it or however you're going to be able to digest this documentary. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.